Today's Teisho will be on case 73 in the Book of Serenity, Cao Shan's fulfillment of filial piety. Introduction: lurking in the grasses, sticking to the trees, one turns into a ghost. Being constrained and unjustly punished, one becomes a spirit. When calling it, you burn paper money and present a horse. When repelling it, you curse water and write charms. How can you get peace in the family? Case. A monk asked Cao Shan, how is it when the morning clothes are not worn? Cao Shan said, today, Cao Shan's filial duty is fulfilled. The monk said, how about after the fulfillment of your filial duty? Cao Shan said, Cao Shan likes to get falling down drunk. Verse. The pure household has no neighbors. For long years, staying in sweeping, not admitting any dust, where the light turns, the moon tilts at the remaining dawn. When the forms of the hexagrams are distinguished, then are established winter and spring. Having freshly fulfilled filial duty, when one meets the spring, walking drunk, singing crazily, turban hanging down, ambling with tousled hair, who cares? In great peace, with no concerns, a person falling down drunk. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning, and I hope you had the opportunity to do kinhin outside this beautiful summer day. This is a perfect weather. As you know, we've had a really hot spell, a long hot spell, with the temperatures at, reaching 100. So this beautiful cool weather is just marvelous, of course. Wonderful. I'm so glad you could be here today. Let me say something about the koan, because it's a little bit confusing. Some of it might not be familiar to you. A monk asked Master Cao Shan, how is it when the morning clothes are not worn? Now, that's a very important question. In the context of the subject of the koan, which is filial piety. In Chinese culture, traditional Chinese culture, especially Confucianism, one of the highest virtues is ren, which could be defined as humaneness. In fact, ren is really the essence of the Confucian value system. So Master Kung put great emphasis on always behaving with the utmost humaneness in your dealings with people at every level. And so of particular importance for Master Kung was humaneness in the context of relationships with your parents. So it's quite important to think about this. In the West, we have a rather different attitude about families than people in Asia, or at least I think that's sometimes the case. When I was growing up, my parents were kind of in my way, if I can put it that way. Maybe I was unusual, but it seemed like every time I wanted to do something that was fun, my mother or my father were telling me no, you know. And it used to really bug me. You know, my mother taught me to drive because my father was away on a naval training exercise for about 6 months at one time. And so my mother, I begged my mother to let me drive because all my friends already had their license. And my mother didn't really know how to teach anybody to drive, and she was afraid to have me out on the street because I wasn't really very coordinated physically. And also, I was not very mature in some ways at that time. So she used to drive over to a big parking lot, a big vacant parking lot on the base, and she'd just make me drive up and down the parking lot. She'd take me to this parking lot, and we'd spend like a couple hours driving, then we'd go home. And I'd say, when am I going to get my license? And she'd say, we need more practice. You know, this went on. She was just stalling, so I didn't get a license. You know. Eventually, she made me take a driver's ed course, and I finally got my license. And I'm actually a terrible driver. I work very hard just to be a decent driver, and I think my mother was right. It's a miracle. In fact, my sister and my brother used to say, it's a miracle I wasn't killed driving. I'm just not a very good driver. So my mother was trying to protect me, but she was just in my way. And my father was like that too. It seemed every time I wanted to do something fun, it was always no, 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 no. And I would have arguments with my parents. And my father used to say, look, when you're 18, you're on your own, you can do whatever you want. I've heard that from other parents too. I've heard them say that to their sons or their daughters. When you're 18, you're on your own, you can do whatever you want. And then, you know, you go away from your parents, and maybe I'm somewhat unusual, but, you know, I was glad to be free from my parents. I was glad to be out from under their control. And when I was free, I really enjoyed it. It made me really happy. Now, I think this is kind of a Western, maybe I'm unusual. I think I wasn't very grateful to my parents when I was young. But I think a lot of Westerners feel this way. This is sort of what the family relationship can be about. It's like your parents are on your case. They're either pushing you or they're holding you back. And then you break free, you get out in the world, and you can be your own person. And you go back and see them sometime, and they either like what you've become or they don't like it, but, you know, you have to be your own person. You're 18, you're a free person, you can vote, you can do what you want. But in the context of Asian culture, it's very different. You know, Master Kung, Confucius, put a great deal of emphasis on being appreciative for the sacrifices that parents have to make. And when I began to be interested in Chinese culture, it really changed the way I looked at my own parents. Because I had always seen my parents as these people who were on my case, holding me back or pushing me in some direction or another. And then I remember reading Confucius. And it really made me think about my parents, because I suddenly realized my parents had made tremendous sacrifices to bring me into the world and to raise me up. And I had been so selfish that all I saw was an obstacle. You know, when I looked at my parents, all I saw were obstacles to my happiness and freedom. And I remembered, you know, as an adult, the times my father would take my brother and me to the shoe store and buy us new shoes. When he didn't have new shoes. My father was a low-level naval officer, and he had to have, you know, very shiny shoes. And he had only, at that time, only like a couple pair of shoes, and in one of his pair there was like a hole. I remember seeing a hole in the bottom of his sole. They make shoes differently now than they used to. You don't ever see holes in shoes anymore because they have these super compounds like Vibram that never wear out. But in the old days, shoes, the bottom of shoes were made out of leather, just like the top, many layers of leather sandwiched together. If you owned shoes for a year or so, you wore right through the leather. So sometimes you'd see people who didn't have a lot of money, they actually had holes in their shoes, in the soles of their shoes. And I remember my father actually used to have soles that were worn through. And sometimes, especially in his casual shoes, you know, he just had to wear them. And, you know, I can remember my parents doing other things too, making other kinds of sacrifices so we could be happy, my brother and I. I know my parents wanted to go on a vacation one summer, and it never happened. And years later, I realized it probably never happened because they bought me a bicycle. You know, this my as I say, my parents didn't have a lot of money in those days, and buying a bicycle would have probably been the money they had to have some time, free time, up in New York State, where they used to go on vacation. So only as an adult, and actually only after I read Confucius, did I really have a different view of my parents, and I really realized how ungrateful I had been to them. And how little I had appreciated their sacrifices. So I think this aspect of Chinese culture is really something we can all learn from. Idea of, we say filial piety is the translation, but it really means respecting the sacrifices of your parents. Realize your parents have given you this life, they've made tremendous sacrifices, and you really need to love your parents. You know, even if they've been to tell you, my mother and my father, I love them both. My mother's still alive, my father's no longer alive. But, you know, both could be kind of like a pain in the ass, you know. They really were, in a certain way, you know, always bugging me about something, and they could have been better at being parents. But, you know, on the other hand, they really wanted me to turn out to be a decent human being, and they worked hard, and everybody makes mistakes. And at the end of the day, I'm really tremendously grateful to them. So, you know, this what we call filial piety, it sounds so weird, or it sounds so distasteful, right? Filial piety, you know, it sounds. Master Kung was really getting at was respect for the sacrifices of one's parents, you know, people who have helped you to be the person you are today. So this koan is about really, how do we interact, not just with our parents, but with other people too? What do we owe to other people? You could put it that way. What do we owe to other people, to our parents, starting with our parents, to our brothers and sisters, to our in-laws, to our spouses, to people in our neighborhoods, and so on? What do we owe? And this is a complicated question, I think, because, on the surface, it looks easy enough. You know, love and respect your parents. Love and respect your parents. You know, be kind to your neighbor. Do to other people as you would have them do to you. This idea. You know. So easy enough. But the koan's going to push this issue a little deeper. A monk asked Kaoshan, how is it when the mourning clothes are not worn? See, now this is sort of a shocking koan in the context of Chinese culture. Because the word mourning clothes here refers to clothes you wear at a funeral. It's not M-O-R-N-I-N-G, it's M-O-U-R-I-N-I-N-G, mourning. So you're in mourning. So in the West, when we're in mourning, traditionally, it's not true anymore, but traditionally, when people were in mourning, they often wore like dark colors, like black. So a century ago in the United States, a widow, for example, would wear black clothes a certain amount of time after her husband died. In Chinese culture, mourning clothes are often made out of flax or hemp, linen, unbleached linen, or hemp, like almost like burlap. And when somebody, the family might wear this, this is a, at least in some versions of Chinese culture, family might wear these mourning clothes at the funeral. And it's a kind of unbleached, raw fabric, rather crude fabric. And if you ever see photographs of people, Chinese people, it looks like they're wearing like loose burlap clothes. It's probably a photograph of a funeral. So part of the way you show your respect for your parents' sacrifices in bringing you up is to, of course, go to their funeral and wear the mourning clothes of a son or daughter who respects their sacrifice. See, this is part of this Confucius idea of ren, or humaneness, right? Humaneness. So a monk asked Kaoshan, how is it when the mourning clothes are not worn? See, it's funeral day, and all the family is going to the funeral. See, all the family is going to the funeral, and on your bed, someone has laid out the mourning clothes. But if you're Kaoshan, your master Kaoshan, you don't put them on. They stay on the bed. See, you don't put them on. And so a monk says, what happens when the mourning clothes are not put on? See? So in a way, this would be like this would create quite a big stir in a traditional Chinese culture, because it would be like showing up at a funeral where everybody's supposed to wear black, and you show up sort of like in a Hawaiian shirt. See, it would be scandalous. How is it when the mourning clothes are not worn? Kaoshan said, when the mourning clothes are not worn, I have done my duty. I have done my duty to my parents when I don't put on the mourning clothes. I've done my duty to my parents when I show up at the funeral in my Hawaiian shirt. See? So this is a kind of a strange statement. Yeah? Okay. And the monk says, well, how is it after you've done your filial duty, after you've shown your reverence for your parents, then what happens? Kaoshan says, I get falling down drunk. See. So this is the koan. There's two parts to this koan. Not wearing the mourning clothes, and the other part is getting fallen down drunk. Okay. So if you... your parents have died, one of your parents has died, everybody's at the funeral, they're all wearing dark colors, you show up in your Hawaiian shirt, that's going to be a shocker to everybody. And then after the ceremony, everybody retires for the reception, and you start hammering down the wine or the spirits, and you're falling down drunk. This is like a disgraceful behavior. Right? So how could this be praised in the koan? That's what this koan is really all about. It's really about, you know, how do we live in this world? What do we owe to this world? You know, and that's a very complicated question. It seems simple on the face of it, right? Until you begin to look around a little more carefully. One of our members has just come back from a conference, professional conference. And another one is at a professional conference right now. I was talking to this person, and I said, how did it go at your professional conference? And she said something like, it went well, but it was a little strange. The person I was talking to does a lot of zazen, and is sort of in the Zen world a lot of the time. So she's often sitting in our community here at the university, and went away to the professional conference, and it's like being in another world. This happens to me too. I don't go to so many conferences anymore, but when I was younger, I used to go to quite a few because I wanted to get tenure and published. And I learned a lot from these conferences. And I would also, especially when I was in graduate school, I was training at the Seattle Zen Center, just like this person. I was sitting every day, faithfully practicing, going to Sesshin, and I would do my write my dissertation and do my research at the library. But when I would go to these conferences, it was like being a spy in another country. You know, it felt like that. Because the values of the conference were so different from the values of my sangha, where I practiced. You know, the society on the face of it seems perfectly sane. You know, our society on the face of it seems perfectly sane. You know, people go to graduate school, they study, and they get jobs at universities. People get out of college and they go into business and they work hard and they rise up in business. You know, you might start out as a representative in the state legislature. Maybe you're an attorney and you decide to go into politics, and you become a legislator in the state legislature, and then you become a state senator or a governor, and then one day you're president of the United States. You know. Every step of the way, it all seems rational, seems to make sense. You know, it all seems to make sense, right? And if you look at society from a distance, it can seem very sane, very trustworthy, and so on. You know, this is reality, right? It's reality. So you go to a professional conference and you think, well, this is reality. This is, you know, here these people are all intelligent, capable, well-meaning people, and you might go to a particular panel, and then you might have kind of a surprise, because you go to the panel and somebody stands up and presents his ideas, and they're just ideas. You know, somebody says, here's what my research has told me, blah blah blah. And then all of a sudden, somebody in the audience during the question period stands up and is furious, right? I mean, this has certainly happened to me, furious. And just attacks the speaker. And says, how can you say this? This is ridiculous. Pretty soon everybody's arguing. The faces are getting red. And this doesn't happen all the time. But it does happen. You know? And when it happens, if you're observant, if you're looking, you say, well, that's strange, because I thought everything was okay. I thought, you know, this is just normal human society, peaceful. People are, you know. But every once in a while, there's like a little eruption. And you suddenly say, gee, how did that happen, right? You know, here's a very nice person giving a paper, and here's another colleague in the audience, and the colleague starts attacking the person on the panel. The person on the panel feels attacked, and so he attacks the attacker, right? How did that happen? You know, and maybe it all gets smoothed over. You know, maybe the person who's running the panel stands up and tells a joke, and sort of everybody laughs nervously, right? And it all goes back down. Then you go after all the papers, and you go to the bar with your colleagues, and you have a drink. And, you know, they start talking about this event. Did you see that? You know, did you see Smith go after Jones? You know, I hear they hate each other. You know, well, Jones is a jerk. You know, he's totally wrong. His research stinks, you know. Oh, I don't think so. I think Smith is the one who stinks, you know. And so they go on, you know, you get arguments about the argument, you know. People drink a little too much and they say things they regret. So I think this person was just saying, you know, when she went to this conference, it was like being a spy in another country instead of looking at unfamiliar customs. When you look at culture that way, when you look at a society that way, you begin to see that everything doesn't really go always so smoothly. So, you know, it's not always so smooth. Underneath the surface, there's a lot of tension sometimes, because people have, they're not just interested in knowledge, right? Not just knowledge is one of the things, but also interested in power, interested in personal advancement, interested in acquiring territory, right? And then, you know, those things can all be taken away from you. The respect of others can be taken away from you. your personal power can be taken away from you. And if people are trying to take things away from you, you get mad, right? So, you know, right under the surface, it looks normal, looks okay, but right under the surface, they're like these energies that could be very destructive under the right circumstances. And normally, we don't think about this. You know, normally, we just go along as though our society were totally sane, right? Totally. We just assume the baseline of reality is sanity, right? The society is sane, of course. How could it not be? You know, if you see your neighbor, you say hello to your neighbor, and you assume your neighbor says hello to you, doesn't throw anything at you, so it must be a decent person, right? Now, I have a neighbor who's a wonderful guy. His name is Brian. And he used to be a professor of music at Rutgers, and then he set up his own company. He actually he books concerts now, like classical music concerts. He's in the production side of classical music. And his wife is a singer. And you know, Brian, we've had Brian over to our house we've had sort of neighborhood parties, and Brian and his wife have come over, and whenever I see, we're always very friendly. And, you know, for about 10 years, Brian would walk his dog, a big Irish setter. I'm sorry, it was a golden retriever, a big golden retriever, every day. And I'm not kidding you. He would walk the dog up the street and down the street, and he would stop in front of the sidewalk that leads into the street from our house, from my house. And his dog would go to the bathroom on the sidewalk, right in front of my house. You know, now, part of the etiquette of taking your dog out these days to relieve himself is to take along a little baggie and pick it up. And Brian would never pick it up. This went on for like 10 years, right? And I like Brian, and I didn't confront him, you know? I just thought, what the heck? But every once in a while, I had to be very vigilant, right? Because I'm on my way to work, I'm getting toward my car, and I, oh no! You know. So, you know, I had to clean off my shoes, this sort of thing, right? And it happened many times in about 10 years, you know. So, you know, I made a habit of I had on the porch, I had the shovel, and periodically I just go shovel it all off into the bushes, you know. And I never confronted him. And eventually the dog died, as a matter of fact. And I loved the dog. I don't hold it against the dog. His dog was the sweetest dog. Why did he do that, you know? I mean, it was potentially a flammable situation, right? You know. Humans have strange motivations, you know. Sometimes it's just carelessness. Sometimes it's something, they're sending you some kind of a message, you know. I don't know what, you know. But the point is that under the surface, things are not as they seem. And normally, we don't pay it much attention until it gets to the point where you can't ignore it, right? Where there's like a violent episode at a conference, or where you suddenly have explosions of violence in the real world, right? So, I mean, right now, we have conflicts in many parts of the world, really violent, horrible conflicts. We have a war going on in the Middle East between the Hezbollah and Israel, and between Israel and guerrillas in Palestine. Over the last few days, conflict has broken out in Sri Lanka again, regrettably. And so now the Tamils and the Sinhalese are virtually at war. And, of course, the Kashmir situation could explode at any minute. And India is on high alert. Other parts of the world, too, it's just like you think everything's going along so well, and then there's like this explosion of violence. And you might say, you know, it's always a shock in a way, right? It's always, how did this happen? You know, one minute everything was okay, and the next minute there's bomb threats on a plane. How did this happen? And I think it remains a mystery until we begin to realize that ordinary human life is not sane. In my opinion, it's not. It pretends to be sane, and it looks sane from a distance. But a lot of the things we believe in, and a lot of the things we cling to, are actually rather destructive, rather dangerous. I can't help but think that one of the dangerous aspects of our life is identity, you know? So my feeling is that many of the conflicts that are going on around the world have to do with identity. You know, so basically, you might say, this person, you know, this person it has done me an injury, and it's because of who I am. It's a lot of conflicts. So, for example, in India, you know, the issue in Kashmir has a lot to do with religion, people say, but really with identity, right? People who are Kashmiris don't want to be part of India, as I understand it. They want to be Kashmiris. And they say to be a Kashmiri is to be like a Muslim, basically. And of course, they feel that they have a right to secede from India, and India says, well, wait a minute, you know, there are many Muslims in India. You can be a part of our country and still be a Muslim. But the tensions have to do with identity, I think, a lot of it. And I think this is true in the Middle East. You know, it's not the war between that's going on in Lebanon now is not just about property. A lot of it has to do with identity, with basically people who understand themselves to be Jews versus people who understand themselves to be Arabs or Muslims. And I think the element of identity really, really plays a key role in this. Of course, a little more than half a century ago, in Europe, identity was also very important. If you were a Jew, it could cost you your life in Germany. People who grew up speaking the same language might be in appearance identical, and had the same, both liked Wiener Schnitzels and sauerkraut, you know, so on. Both liked opera, you know. Both read Goethe or whoever, you know. And suddenly, one person was a target, and the other was the pursuer. You know, so I just think that this question of what do we owe our society is complicated, because our society isn't always sane, and I don't think it can. I think the baseline for human culture is not sanity, because human culture has such investments in illusion. I think identity is really necessary. It's important for people to be able to say, I'm an American, right? I'm an American, and I'm proud to be an American. Or, I'm Chinese, and I'm proud to be Chinese. I'm Indian, and I'm proud to be from India. You know, this is a healthy, I guess, normal in a certain way. But you know, a lot of the conflicts we have come from the same source. You know, my feeling is that identity is really, really one of the most dangerous. It's one of the most necessary things for humans, right? We want to say, I'm Chinese, I'm Japanese, I'm American. You know? On the other hand, just so I'm Jewish, I'm Christian, I'm Muslim, I'm Buddhist. These are so important. This is like the foundation of human life. But it's so dangerous, right? So dangerous. Because if you're not what I am, you know, suddenly there's these tensions, and what you are can threaten what I am, and so on. And I think we see this all over the world right now. These are struggles partly about power, and partly about identity. I think that the Muslim world feels very threatened by the West. At least a certain sector of the Muslim world is very comfortable with the West. But there's certainly a sector that feels very threatened by the West, and with good reason. If you read history. You know, the West has been very aggressive and exploitative in many ways, and continues to be. So very threatened. And then we feel threatened. You know, I was reading this. I was reading this book the other day about Europe and how it's changing. And they were just saying that the national identity is really not so important in much of Western Europe anymore. And the author was talking about the fact that, about 70 years ago, 100 years ago, little French boys used to lie down in the field and look at the clouds. You know, you've probably done this when you were a kid. You lie down in the grass and look up at the clouds and just sort of dream, right? Have your daydreams. And this author said little French boys would lie down in the fields and look up at the clouds. And they would have dreams of conquering Germany, right, and killing the Germans. Right? Really, this is true. You know, and there I marched into Berlin, right, and the city fell before me, right, like Napoleon, right. The dream like being like Napoleon. Little boys have little soldiers, right. You know, and of course they said little German boys would lie in their fields over in Germany, look at the clouds drifting by, and think, you know, and then Paris fell to my army. Right? And you know, and this really went on for more than a century, and something like maybe 18 million people died in World War I, even larger, almost 55 million died in World War II as a result of these little boys dreaming these dreams in the field, right? And so. And the irony of it all is, you know, that the French and the Germans used to be one country long ago, like 1,000 years ago. If you've heard of Charlemagne, the French say Charlemagne, and the Germans say Carlo Magnus. And they both he's their great ancestor, right, in both countries. They killed millions of, Germans killed millions of Frenchmen, Frenchmen killed millions of Germans. And this is going on all over the world, even as we speak. I think identity is really important, but we Zen people don't really believe in identity. You know, we just don't. We know you need one, just like you need. You know, I have a house. I own a house. And on the title to the house it says Kurt and Barbara Spellmeyer, you know, but I'm really not Kurt Spellmeyer, so help me, I'm not. When I sit on the cushion, and I enter samadhi, and then I enter mushin, I'm not. That my true self is not Kurt Spellmeyer. Kurt Spellmeyer is just a name. Right? It's absurd, really. To take these identities too seriously. You know, I was at the Grand Canyon years ago, and I remember going into the lodge there and getting a little brochure on the Grand Canyon. And it had a picture of the Grand Canyon, and the picture said, American Beauty. Now, I have to tell you, I don't think the Grand Canyon is American beauty, because I don't think the Grand Canyon is American. I don't think it is. You know, the Grand Canyon is millions, America is 200 years old, but the Grand Canyon is millions of years old, right? You know, the Grand Canyon was here long before America, and the Grand Canyon will be here someday people are going to go, America, who's he? Right? It's going to happen. And it's not a bad thing at all, as a matter of fact, in my opinion. Grand Canyon will still be there. You know, if you look at India, you know, India is a country now. At other times, not a country. You know, different country. China, same thing. You know, all of these things. You know, China, America, Mexico. These are all like brief moments in an infinite expanse of time. Right? We were humans long before we were Americans, Chinese, Muslims, Christians, Buddhists. These are like very fleeting, very transient manifestations of something much bigger, you know, in my opinion. And we hold on to them desperately because we know they're not real. We know they're not real. This is why we have to hold on so desperately. I don't think the Grand Canyon is American. And you know, today, French and Germans, they're best friends. Yesterday they were trying to kill each other. 1,000 years ago, they were the same people. 1,000 years from now, let's hope they're still the same people. But I think it's very important not to take any of these identities too seriously. Yeah? And so, you know, then the question is, so what do we owe to our society? What do we owe to our society? What do we owe to our family? What do we owe to our society? And everybody, this is a koan, right? There's no right answer. There's no right answer. But everybody has to ask this question, you know, what do I owe to my family? What do I owe to my friends, my neighborhood, my profession, my country, you know, and so on. And everybody has to answer this for himself or herself. But, you know, the way we Zen people answer it is a little different. You know, because most people, I think, look to others for their answer. You know, so, you know, basically, if I want to decide who I am, I try to find a common identity with other people by, you know, maybe I buy a flag and I hang it outside my house. Or maybe I, you know, put a bumper sticker on my car that says, these colors never run, right? I see this around, right? These colors never run. And you can understand, after 9/11, we're feeling very unstable. And people who do that, you know, are not, I don't think, to be treated with contempt, because I as a sort of a lefty and as an internationalist, I don't like it. You know, it does tick me off, right? I wouldn't be honest with you if I said, it kind of bothers me, I have to tell you the truth. But, you know, when I sit on the cushion for a while and I enter Mushin, I realize that my contempt for this is a product of my own uneasiness, and that these people are just frightened, right? When people get frightened, they try to form alliances with other people based upon commonalities, right? So, you know, basically, if I'm frightened, I might say, well, we're all Americans. Or I might say, well, at least we're all Christians. Or we're all Buddhists. Or at least we're all Muslims. Or I can say, at least we're all white. Or I can say, at least we're all not white. This is a human nature, right? At least we're all professionals. At least we're all rich. At least we're all poor. And I understand, at least we're all men, right? At least we're all women. We get scared, we start looking for these kinds of commonalities that will, like, form a kind of protective barrier, right? And I guess we need them a little bit, but not, we shouldn't need them too much. You know, and the Zen way of life is just not to go that route. You know, the Zen way of life is to sit on the cushion and enter Mushin until everything disappears and you face your true nature, which has no birth and no death, and it has no nationality, and it has no religion, and it has no race, and it has no gender. And in my opinion, that is my true self. That's where I go for my answers. And I think that when people don't go there, they get into trouble, my opinion. So everybody has to find his own answer, her own answer. But if you look at the history of human beings, generally speaking, too much, you know, it's important to be grateful to your parents, you know? I love my parents. But if you sit on the cushion long enough, you begin to realize that everyone is my mother and my father. Everyone is my son and my daughter. You know, everyone is my brother and my sister. This, not based upon what they are, you know, because actually we're all different in many ways. But on a deeper, on this deeper level, we all, there's like a common root, common source. You know, I believe, and I, you know, you might not agree with me, but at the heart of every person, there's this emptiness, and they're either terrified of it, or they learn to love it and live in it, yeah, consciously and happily. And basically, this is what we're all afraid of, and it's actually, I think, where we all come from. And so this issue of being a good son or daughter is a little complicated. Because make sure you're the good son or daughter to the right mother and father, yeah? My mother and father have no name and no face, no birth and no death. I mean, that's the truth. And you know, when you experience life that way, I think it becomes very beautiful. You know, really beautiful. You know, it's a little bit scary to say no to your parents. You know, like my father actually was really against my practicing Zen. My father did not like this this strange Asian religion. And he didn't approve of my doing this at all. And you know, I had to decide: am I going to be my father's son, or I'm going to do something that I have to, that my true nature tells me I have to do? And I loved my father all his life, but I had to listen to my true nature. Yeah. And I'm so glad I did, because for me anyway, this path has been really has brought me indescribable happiness. Indescribable happiness. It's like falling down drunk. Yeah. It's difficult not to go with the flow. You know, that's not the right word. Maybe it's difficult not to walk in the same direction as everybody else. It's difficult to be different, right? Difficult to be different. People don't like the guy who shows up at the funeral in a Hawaiian shirt, you know. If everybody else has a flag out in front of his house and you don't, you know, under the right circumstances, that could mean a rock through your window. It might mean nothing. We hope it means nothing. But you know, basically, in my experience, I'm just speaking only for myself. You know, when I didn't put on the funeral clothes, my life became very beautiful, very wonderful. And sometimes I don't know, falling down drunk doesn't exactly describe it, but pretty nice. Pretty beautiful life. And I really think that people who live in that emptiness can do a lot of good in this world. You know, I think it's very hard after a while for Sinhalese Buddhists to talk to Tamil Hindus or Tamil Christians in the middle of a civil war. And you need somebody who's kind of like a spy from another country, right? Sort of not so invested. And I think that the more people there are who understand what I'm talking about, you know, it seems a very, in the face of a world that's, you know, like going up in flames, you think, well, what good is doing zazen, right? You know. But I think this path is very important. And the person who is not, I my true self, I'm not a Christian, I'm not a Buddhist, I'm not a Muslim, I'm not a Jew, I'm not an American, I'm not China. But you know, in a certain way, I can be all of those things. They're all my heritage. You know, when I look at China, I feel like I'm Chinese. Honestly, I love Chinese culture so much. And I actually love Japanese culture so much. And I can't speak a word, but I feel like it's my home, you know? And sometimes I'll be in a museum and I'll be looking at the French Impressionists and I just feel like speaking French, you know, even though my French is terrible. It's all my family. It's all my house. It's all your house. If you can live this way. You have to be empty inside, and then it's just like a party outside all the time. So let's hope that this emptiness can sprout in everybody's heart like a flower, you know? Just like a beautiful plant taking root. You know, who knows? We may even survive. That would be great, wouldn't it? A monk asked Kaoshan, how is it when the morning clothes are not worn? You didn't even put on the morning clothes at the funeral. Kaoshan said, today I've done my filial duty. I've been true to my true nature. See, not American, not Muslim, not Christian. I'm true to my true nature. The monk said, well, what about after you've done your filial duty? He said, this world is so beautiful. I love you. You're my brother, my sister, my father, my dog. Kaoshan likes to get falling down drunk. The pure household has no neighbors. Everybody's in your house. So if your house is... If you emptiness is always at home, then every place is your house. For long years I stayed inside sweeping, not admitting any dust. And where the light turns, the moon remains at dawn. When the forms of the hexagrams are distinguished, then are established dawn and spring. Having freshly fulfilled filial duty, then one meets spring. Each time you become empty, you encounter your true self in everyone. Walking drunk, singing crazily, your turban hanging down, ambling with tousled hair, who cares? In great peace, with no concerns, a man falling down drunk.